Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. We are in the middle of a series of programs called Timely Tidbits, stories that have been accumulating in a pile on my desk. Some aren't so timely anymore, I'll admit, and some are not really tidbits, but they all contain good, solid information that I want to share with you. So today it's Timely Tidbits Part 2. You'll hear about an affordable tablet for the blind, the bionic eye, which is commonly called Argus II, and then we'll take a journey way back in history to learn about Laura Bridgman. First, it comes from MIT Technology Review. The headline reads, "In Pursuit of an Affordable Tablet for the Blind." The subheadline reads, "By borrowing from microfluidics, a team of University of Michigan researchers are reinventing the Braille display to be cheaper and more useful." Now, that term, microfluidics, I admit I had to look it up. I sort of had an idea based on root words what it was talking about, but they say that it's the microfluidics is the behavior of fluids channeled through tiny channels, chambers, and tunnels. This is all on a sub-millimeter scale, microfluidics at the University of Michigan. This was written by Sidney Brewster. An inexpensive full-page Braille tablet could make topics like science and math more easily accessible to people who are blind, according to a team of researchers who have built a prototype device. The device, which is under development at the University of Michigan, uses liquid or air to fill tiny bubbles, which then pop up and create the blocks of raised dots that make up Braille. Each bubble has what is essentially a logic gate that opens or remains closed to control the flow of liquid after each command. This is according to Sheila O'Madrain, a professor of performing arts technology who collaborated on the tablet. Existing refreshable Braille displays tend to max out at one line of text and cost several thousand dollars. They use plastic pins pushed up and down by a motor. This Michigan team, University of Michigan team, found it impossible to pack the pins in densely enough to create a reasonably sized full-page display, and as a result, started from scratch with the microfluidic option. The switch could help them make the final product tablet-sized instead of laptop-sized, like existing refreshable displays. The tablet borrows manufacturing techniques from the silicon industry, where chips are laid down in layers instead of having many small parts to assemble. As a result, the Michigan team is aiming to offer a Braille tablet for less than $1,000. Here's a quote in the article. "My observation is that, currently, even many of us who read Braille well find reading it with single-line Braille displays slower and more tiring than using text-to-speech or audio materials," says Chris Danielson, a spokesperson for the National Federation of the Blind. He continues by saying, "I think this product would dramatically change with a larger display, especially one at a reasonable price point." As access to text-to-speech software has grown, pressure to learn Braille has dropped. A 2009 report from the National Federation of the Blind stated that less than 10% of blind children were learning Braille at the time, compared with 50 to 60% at Braille's height in the 1960s. But that doesn't mean there is no longer a need for the 200-year-old writing system. Braille books, for example, have long been used to show the blind textured images. Text-to-speech software can't convey the same visual information. However, if there isn't a book available, people with visual impairments have to turn to another person to prepare them materials, and this can be expensive. Here's a quote. "Anything where you want to be able to see stuff written down, like coding or music or even just mathematics, you really have to work in Braille," says O'Madrain. who is visually impaired herself. She continues, that just means for a lot of people, these things are not accessible or not available. Omadrian believes the team is about a year and a half away from actually commercializing this technology, which may be used for an application other than Braille at first. That would drive the cost down for its later adoption by people who are blind. The article ends with a quote, it would be great to see these getting into schools so children can learn to read math and science materials. This is a quote from Sheila Omadrain. And once again, this is from the University of Michigan in pursuit of an affordable tablet for the blind. The next article, it actually came from our local newspaper here in Rochester, New York, where this program originates. This came from a University of Rochester press release. U of R Medicine uses, quote-unquote, bionic eye to restore some vision to blind Syracuse woman. The Flaum Eye Institute, first in New York, to implant the new FDA-approved retinal device to improve quality of life. This article was printed originally in the latter part of October in 2017. And I will also follow up this short article from the newspaper with a detailed article from Wikipedia about more of the history of this bionic eye concept. So we start with the article from the U of R, University of Rochester. A 71-year-old woman blinded by an inherited disease recently thrilled University of Rochester doctors by reaching out and grabbing her ophthalmologist's hand after receiving a bionic eye. The device allows her to distinguish light and motion, which she hasn't been able to do in decades. A quote, I saw his hand. I couldn't miss that, said Kalita Rahman, a Syracuse area resident who once competed in the Olympics. She is the first person in New York State to receive the FDA-approved Argus II retinal prosthesis system. There are fewer than 100 people in the United States that have this device, designed for people who have lost their vision as a result of retinitis pigmentosa. A quote, we dedicate our careers to restoring and improving vision and preventing vision loss. The ability to see, someone who couldn't see before, start to see again, is very rewarding, said Mina Chung, a doctor at the Flaum Eye Institute. She worked with retina specialist Dr. A.J. Kurian and anesthesiologist Dr. Anil Pishiroti. They implanted the device on August 29th of 2017, and the ophthalmologists activated it on September 24th. When she reached out and grabbed Dr. Kurian's hand, and they kind of held hands together, that was pretty exciting, Dr. Chung said. I think it's going to be an amazing advance for her. Retinitis pigmentosa is a rare hereditary disease that causes progressive degeneration of the light-sensitive cells of the retina, leading to blindness. It affects about 1.2 million people worldwide, and there is no treatment. The Argus II device, made by a company called Second Sight, works by converting images captured by a miniature video camera mounted on the patient's glasses into a series of small electrical pulses, which are transmitted wirelessly to an array of electrodes implanted on the surface of the retina. These pulses are intended to stimulate the retina's remaining cells, resulting in the perception of patterns of light in the brain. The patient then learns to interpret these visual patterns and thereby regaining some visual function. The optoelectronic device restores vision by allowing people to see contrast, such as a doorway or light-colored dish on a darker-colored table. And this is all in addition to motion. A quote, this is definitely a game changer for patients who are close to blind or completely blind, said Dr. Kurian. When you have this low level of vision, it can lead to a lot of isolation because they have difficulty getting around. Following activation of the system, patients undergo months of vision training to maximize their ability to interpret these signals and what they are seeing. Doctors Kurian and Chung knew Raman would be the ideal first patient to receive this implantable device because of her determination and her can-do positive attitude. A quote, "This isn't something that automatically works just because we turned it on. It takes a lot of effort on the part of the patient to maximize its use," Dr. Kurian said. Throughout her care, Mrs. Raman has been diligent and dedicated, which is serving her well during her training. Born in East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh, Mrs. Raman was one of 8 children and knows the importance of hard work, regardless of how well she can see. Several siblings and relatives lost their sight to retinitis pigmentosa. When she was just 3 years old, it was clear that she would have the same fate. Her nanny tried to give her an orange, but Raman didn't reach for it because she couldn't see it. Without a cure, she forged ahead, attending school and playing sports, excelling at track and field and badminton. A quote from her, "By the time I was 18, I could barely see the shuttlecock in the air," Raman recalled. I used to bump into things, but I kept going on with my life, and I learned to work around it. She pursued sociology and was on the track team and competed in track and field at the University of Dhaka in Bangladesh. She was also a member of the Pakistan Olympic track and field team in the 1960s. Raman and her husband, Basler, came to the United States in 1970 and raised a son. She continued taking classes at Syracuse University even as her vision diminished, and she relied on visual aids and Braille more and more. This part of the article ends with a quote from her. "I do not let this stop me from doing what needs to be done. I still cook our favorite foods, and I have a fast hand for knitting. I have a really good memory and have learned some tricks to get me through my days." And now from Wikipedia, more about the Argus retinal prosthesis. The Argus retinal prosthesis, known as the Bionic Eye, is an electronic retinal implant manufactured by the American company called Second Sight Medical Products. It's used as a visual prosthesis to improve the vision of people with severe cases of retinitis pigmentosa. The Argus II version of the system was approved for marketing in the European Union in March of 2011. It received approval in the U.S. in February of 2013 under what's called a humanitarian device exemption. The Argus II system costs about $150,000, and that would be excluding the cost of the implantation surgery and training to use the device. The Argus II is specifically designed to treat people with retinitis pigmentosa. The device was approved with data from a single-arm clinical trial that enrolled 30 people with severe retinitis pigmentosa. The longest follow-up on a trial subject was 38.3 months. People in the trial received the implant in only one eye, and tests were conducted with the device switched on or switched off as a control. With the device switched on, about 23 of the subjects had improvement in their ability to see. 96% of the subjects were better able to identify a white square on a black computer screen. 57% were more able to determine the direction in which a white bar moved across a black computer screen. With the device switched on, about 60% were able to accurately walk to a door that was 20 feet away. And this is opposed to only 5% who could do that with the device switched off. Some side effects you might be wondering about. Among the 30 subjects in the clinical trial, there were 9 serious adverse effects recorded, including lower than normal intraocular pressure, erosion of the conjunctiva, reopening of the surgical wound, inflammation inside the eye, and retinal detachments. There is also a risk of bacterial infection from the implanted cables that connect the implant to the signal processor. The actual procedure now. The implantation procedure takes several hours, with the person receiving the implant under general anesthesia. The surgeon removes the vitreous humor and any membranes on the retina where the implant will be placed. The implant is attached to the surface of the retina with a tack. The cables connecting the implant to the processor are run through a region near where the iris and the sclera touch. And a little bit more about the actual device, or let's do the history of the device. That's what I was interested in, when it was first actually begun. The implant's manufacturer, Second Sight Medical Products, was founded in Sylmar, California in 1998 by Alfred Mann, Samuel Williams, and Gunnar Bjorg. Williams, an investor in a cochlear implant company operated by Mann, approached Mann about founding a company to develop a similar product for the eye. Mann called a meeting with the two of them and Robert Greenberg, who worked at Mann's foundation. Greenberg had previously worked on retinal prosthetics as a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University and was appointed CEO of the new company when it was launched. The first version of the prosthesis, the Argus One, was clinically tested on 6 people starting in 2002. The second version, the Argus II, was designed to be smaller and easier to implant and was co-invented by Mark Humayun of the USC Eye Institute, who had been involved in the clinical testing of the Argus I. The Argus II was first tested in Mexico, and then a 30-person clinical trial that you heard about was conducted in 10 medical centers across Europe and the United States. And as you know, in February of 2013, the FDA in the United States approved the Argus II under humanitarian device exemption, authorizing its use for up to 4,000 people in the U.S. per year. Okay, now we will go on with our step back into history. This is a person whose name is Laura Dewey Lynn Bridgman. Laura Bridgman. She was born December 21st, 1829, died in May of 1889. She is known as the first deaf-blind American child to gain a significant education in the English language 50 years before the more famous Helen Keller. However, there are accounts of deaf-blind people communicating in tactile sign language before this time. One was the deaf-blind person called Victorine Morisot, and she had successfully learned French as a child some years earlier. But we'll go now to Laura Bridgman. Laura Bridgman was born at Hanover, New Hampshire, and if you know, this is the home of Dartmouth College. She was the third daughter of Daniel Bridgman, a Baptist farmer, and his wife Harmony. Was the daughter of Cushman Downer and the granddaughter of Joseph Downer, one of the first 5 settlers of Thetford, Vermont. Laura was a delicate infant, puny and rickety, and was subject to fits up to the 20 months old, but otherwise seemed to have normal senses. However, her family was struck with scarlet fever when she was 2 years old. The illness killed her 2 older sisters and brother and left her deaf, blind, and without a sense of smell or taste. Though she gradually recovered health, she remained deaf and blind, but was kindly treated and was in particular made a sort of playmate by an eccentric bachelor friend of the Bridgmans, Mr. Asa Tenney, who, as soon as she could walk, used to take her for rambles through the fields. As a child, she learned to sew and knit through touch, but had no language. Tenney, who apparently had some kind of expressive language disorder himself, associated with Native Americans, probably Abenaki, who used Plains Indian Sign Language. He had begun to teach Laura Bridgman now, the subject of this part of the program, he had begun to teach Laura to express herself using these signs when she was taken away. In 1837, James Barrett of Dartmouth College saw her and mentioned her case to Dr. Mussey, M-U-S-S-E-Y, who was the head of the medical department. He wrote an account which attracted the attention of Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe, the director of the Perkins Institution for the Blind in Boston. He determined to try to get the child into the institution and to attempt to educate her. Her parents assented, and in October of 1837, Laura entered the school. She was a comely child and of a sensitive and affectionate nature, and was imitative insofar as she could follow the actions of others. However, she was limited in her communication to the narrower uses of touch. Her mother, preoccupied with housework, had already ceased to be able to control her, and her father's authority was due to the fear of superior force, not to any reason. Howe, Dr. Howe, had recently met Julia Brace, a deaf-blind resident at the American School for the Deaf, who communicated using tactile sign language. And then he developed a plan to teach the young Laura Bridgman to read and write through tactile means, something that had not been attempted previously, to his knowledge. At first, he and his assistant, Lydia Hall Drew, used words printed with raised letters, and later they progressed to using a manual alphabet expressed through tactile signs. Eventually, she received a broad education. Dr. Howe taught Laura words before the individual letters. His first experiment consisted of pasting little paper labels upon several common articles, such as keys, spoons, and knives. These labels had the names of the article printed in raised letters, which he got her to feel and differentiate. Then he gave her the same labels by themselves, which she learned to associate with the articles they referred to, until, with the spoon or knife alone before her, she could find the right label for each from a mixed-up heap. The next stage was to give her the component letters and teach her to combine them into the words that she knew. Gradually, in this way, she learned all the alphabet and the 10 digits. The whole process showed that she had human intelligence, which only required stimulation, and her own interest in learning became keener as she progressed. Dr. Howe devoted himself with the utmost patience to her education and was rewarded by increasing success. On July 24th in 1839, she first wrote her own name legibly. On June 20th in the next year, 1840, she had her first arithmetic lesson with the aid of a metallic case perforated with square holes, square types being used. And in 19 days, she could add a column of figures amounting to 30. She was in good health and happy and was treated by Dr. Howe as his daughter. Her case already began to interest the public, and others were brought to Dr. Howe for treatment. In 1841, the very next year, Laura began to keep a journal in which she recorded her own day's work and thoughts. In January of 1842, Charles Dickens visited the institution, and afterwards, he wrote enthusiastically in his book called American Notes about Howe's success with Laura. In 1843, funds were obtained for devoting a special teacher to her, and first Miss Swift, and then Miss White, and then Miss Paddock were appointed to that job. Laura, by this time, was learning geography and elementary astronomy. By degrees, she was given religious instruction, but Dr. Howe was intent upon not inculcating dogma before she had grasped the essential beliefs of Christianity and the story in the Bible. She grew up a happy, cheerful girl, loving, optimistic, but with some inclination to irritability, receiving careful education in self-control. In 1860, her eldest sister, Mary's death, prompted a religious crisis, and through the influence of some of her family, she was received into the Baptist Church. She became more pious for some years after that. In 1867, she began writing compositions, which she called poems, and the best one is called Holy Home. I'll read that one for you. Heaven is holy home. Holy home is from everlasting to everlasting. Holy home is summary. Holy home shall endure forever. In 1872, Dr. Howe, having been enabled to build some separate cottages, each supervised by a matron, these cottages were for the blind girls, and Laura was moved from the larger house of the institution into one of these cottages, and there she continued her quiet life. The death of Dr. Howe in 1876 was a great grief to her, but before he died, He had made arrangements by which she would be financially provided for in her home at the institution for the rest of her life. She remained at the institution, taking on household duties and teaching other pupils. In 1887, her jubilee was celebrated there, but in 1889, she was taken ill, and she died on May 24th of 1889. She is buried at Dana Cemetery in Hanover, New Hampshire. The legacy she left behind, her name became familiar as an example of the education of a deaf-blind person. This is Laura Bridgman. Helen Keller's mother, Kate Keller, read Charles Dickens' account and was inspired to seek advice, which led her to hiring a teacher and former pupil at the same school, Annie Sullivan, which you probably know about. Annie Sullivan learned the manual alphabet from Bridgman, which she took back to Helen, along with a doll that Laura Bridgman had made for her. Now, in sort of an aside little tidbit of information for you, a Liberty ship was actually named for Laura Bridgman. Liberty ships were cargo ships built in the United States during World War II. Though British in conception, they were later adapted by the U.S. as they were cheap and quick to build and came to symbolize U.S. wartime industrial output. 18 American shipyards built 2,751 Liberty ships between 1941 and 1945, easily the largest number of ships produced to a single design. The immense effort to build Liberty ships, the sheer number of ships built, and the fact that some of the ships survived far longer than the original design life of 5 years made them the subject of much study today. And one of those ships was named the Laura Bridgman. Now you know why. Well, to end today's Timely Tidbits program, I have an anonymous quote for you. Here it is. If you want to touch the past, touch a rock. If you want to touch the present, touch a flower. If you want to touch the future, touch a life. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.